Are you privileged? Most of us, perhaps understandably, recoil at the question, in part because we don't understand it or never thought about it. Privilege represents the advantages that luck, genetics, family, timing, and location confer on us. But when we assume that we have been responsible for those advantages, which is surprisingly easy to do, we lose sight of the factors that exclude others from having a fair opportunity to thrive. Cherie Etchison, our guest in this show, is one of Europe's leading tech entrepreneurs and now a major voice in the diversity, equity, and inclusion world. She helps leaders to create accountability-driven, inclusive cultures. We talked to her about her work and her recent bestseller, Demanding More.
Hi, folks. Welcome to The Evolving Leader. Scott Allender here, along with my friend and co-host, a man with character, integrity, and principles. Well, most of the time. Mr. John Gomes. How are you feeling today, John?
I'm feeling diminished. I'm feeling really joyful, actually. I've had a great week. I'm feeling energized, looking forward to the weekend. I'm really looking forward to talking to our guest. I loved her book. And I'm feeling open to a question I know that she's going to ask us as well. So, and I particularly think she should ask it of you, Scott, in a very intensive, almost like X-ray type way. So we'll come to that later on.
Now I'm feeling nervous and very unsettled, but also feeling excited about the weekend. It's been so rainy here, and now they say that the sun's coming out, so I'm excited for some summertime weekend fun, and also very eager to talk to our guest, because today we are joined by Cherie Etchison. Cherie is a global diversity, equity, and inclusion leader, advisory board member at Women Who Code, and author of Demanding More, Why Diversity and Inclusion Aren't Happening and What You Can Do About It. Listed as one of the UK's most influential women in technology, Cherie is an international multi-award-winning diversity and inclusion leader who is a global change maker in pushing for equality and equity in every industry. Cherie, we are delighted that you are here. Welcome to The Evolving Leader.
Thank you so much for having me and for that glowing intro.
Well, you're doing something that is part of a critical, important movement, Cherie. So we're delighted that you're here. And so welcome to The Evolving Leader. Can we start by getting a quick tour of your own personal story and your career to date?
Yeah, of course. So I'm Cherie, and I've been doing global diversity, equity, and inclusion leadership for almost a decade now. Certainly before it was, I guess, quite trendy. I feel like I've been doing it that long. I started my career as a software engineer. I have a computer science degree and was an engineer for a number of years. As you can probably tell by my voice, I am Irish. And so I was raised in Ireland, but was adopted at 3 weeks old from Sri Lanka, which is not a place where many Irish people are, as you can imagine. You can also probably imagine that there are not many Sri Lankan people in Ireland. And so both of my parents are white Irish people. And where I grew up was very, very white, as you would probably think. From the census data, Northern Ireland has about 2% of people that are Black, Asian, or minority ethnic backgrounds. Now, that's Northern Ireland as a whole. Where I come from is, I always say, if there are traffic jams or reason why traffic is slow, it's because a farmer is moving his cows from one field to another. So very, very rural, and very, very much less diverse than that 2%. And so I grew up in a very, very white space, had both the privilege of being adopted and having access to the benefits of being raised in somewhere like Ireland, whilst also very much facing a lot of racism and bias and so on from being a person of colour. A lot of people talk about being the only in, let's say, their workplace, in their, I guess, their office or their teams, but actually a lot of people don't have the experience of being the only in your family, in your school, in your village, in your town, and so on. And so my brother, who was also adopted from Sri Lanka, really the only other person of color I knew until I was maybe 15 or so was him. And certainly when I went to university, expanded that horizon because I went to the city in Belfast where there was much more diversity, but even still much less than you would imagine in places like, you know, London or bigger cities. And so I became a software engineer because I was always very interested in the creation of things, of doing things that maybe hadn't been done before or doing things that had been done, but in a better way. And so I did that for a number of years. But whilst I was doing that, it was very, very clear that there's a very unbalanced industry in technology. We know that it's very unbalanced when it comes to women, when it comes to people of color and women of color and so on. And so I guess I wanted to do something as a 22-year-old graduate, which feels like quite a while ago now, so seven or 8 years ago now. And so that's where I found Women Who Code. So at that stage, Women Who Code was a nonprofit based in San Francisco with around 3,000 global members, so quite small. And what they did was they ran free monthly meetups in all of their locations to provide technical skill sets, to provide confidence building, and to bring together like-minded women. But they had no presence when it came to EMEA or the UK. Now, I was in Belfast at this stage, and so I was like, let me do that. Let me try and bring it over here. And so I branched it across to Belfast, then over to Bristol and London, Edinburgh, Dublin, and then different parts of EMEA. And so I led the expansion of that nonprofit for a number of years across those regions. I now sit as a board member, helping them from a strategic perspective. But I really built up a lot of remote teams doing that work, creating partnerships with small companies, big companies, and everything in between. And it got to the stage where I was doing both that and my software engineering career. And I was like, I have two jobs. Why am I doing two jobs when I don't need to? And also, I'm not a very good software engineer. There are much better software engineers out there, but there are actually not a lot of people who were doing the work that I was doing in that same data-driven way. So I made it my full-time job. And since then, I've held senior leadership roles at Deloitte, at Monzo Bank, which is a challenger bank here in the UK, at Peakon, which is a global experience platform that was just recently acquired by Workday. And I just started a new job about 5 weeks ago, press released you out really soon. I'm excited to hopefully be able to talk about it soon. But yeah, it's been a whirlwind. I write for Forbes really regularly on privilege, on creating inclusive technologies, on I write for a whole host of other places. But I mean, for me, I guess my career, it's been a pretty big whirlwind. You know, I'm in a very privileged position to do this work, but I also come from a background, you know, I grew up on free school meals, which are like state provided benefits in the UK. My parents were working class and ended up both heavily disabled. So I guess when we talk about people breaking through a lot of barriers, I've broken through quite a lot of barriers, but it's a privilege to be able to do that still. And it's a privilege to be able to do this work and certainly, you know, to have a book published about the work that I do. It's been a whirlwind for sure.
Would you mind sharing a little bit more about kind of the discrimination you faced growing up?
Yeah, I mean, of course, I think people, but when you don't have that experience, it's very difficult for people to actually really understand the nuance of it. And people regularly will assume that when we talk about, you know, racism and so on, we're talking about very violent, physically violent, for example, instances. And we are talking about that, but we're also talking about very nuanced instances too. So certainly, you know, me and my brother, when you get past the stage of being the cute brown baby, and then you become like a teenager and you get older, and you face quite a lot of racism. Certainly we did growing up, where we would get called, you know, different slurs, we would get called the N-word, we would get called different things. Outside of school, certainly when you start to, I guess, become your own person, you face quite a lot of bullying, because when you're the only in an entire school, the only brown person or black person, the way you're treated is very, very different than everybody else, because you stand out no matter what you do. And when you're a teenager, probably one of the least things that you want to do is stand out, but you don't have a choice. And I think one of the things for me when it came to how we were treated, certainly as a woman, was very different than my brother. So I'm dark skinned, but my brother is actually much darker skinned than me, like much, much darker. And I got to a period, I guess, when we both were facing very similar sort of racist slurs being thrown at us, our families and my dad, for example, having to go to people's houses and tell them, you know, why are your children saying this stuff? What are you doing about it? Going into school and so on to quash that behavior. But it got to, I guess, when I was a teenager, maybe 15, 16 or so, that actually a lot of the very, I guess, verbally violent racism that I did face started to move back. And I started to face a lot more sexism instead then. But my brother still continued to face that very verbally violent and at times, you know, varying on physically violent racism. I always remember very clearly, we went to two separate schools when we were going to secondary school. And my brother went to one school that was slightly further out, but we could walk to the same town within 15 minutes. And he had to walk a longer way to the town because he used to pass another school where a group of people would regularly wait outside for him to walk past and shout stuff at him. And that's very scary when you're, you know, 14, 16, whatever it might be. It's scary at any age, but certainly as a child. And I guess for me, the nuance of the, even now, the discrimination I face is very different. Because it's a more privileged version, but it's more micro, it's smaller, regular things. Like, I'm married to a white Irish man, and, you know, people looking at us as if, what's going on there? or, like, comments about, you know, where am I really from? And when I tell them I'm from County Tyrone in Ireland, I get, but where are you really, really from? And then that's when I walk away from the conversation now, because I don't have to respond to anybody that I don't want to. But even comments around, you know, the type of food that I would eat, people making the assumption that I eat like lots of Indian food. Well, one, I'm Irish. Two, yes, I do really like Indian food, actually. But I'm also Sri Lankan. So there's a lot of assumptions being made that about the things that happen. Even the assumption around what your personality should be. Like, people expect me when they look at me to be really docile because of the stereotypes against Asian women. And I'm very much the opposite of that now because of the career that I've had. But yeah, you take stock of those things quite a lot, and especially when you're in an interracial relationship, because the experience my husband has is very different to mine, despite the fact, you know, we come from very similar backgrounds. His home house and my home house are about a 10-minute drive away from each other back home in Ireland, but he's a 6'2" white Irish man, and so he doesn't have the same worries that I have. He has them now because he's married to me, but he doesn't have the same way of existing in the world, I think is the best way to put it.
I think there's some point you're raising there about how the nuance has changed. It's like layers of an onion as you peel it back. So, you know, a lot of people might regard themselves as being, you know, take a front at the idea that they were prejudiced, racist, biased against people of colour or gender and so on. But they don't necessarily see the assumptions they're making in that respect. And so this phrase microaggression has now started to become the next layer of the onion in terms of things that people inadvertently do that they don't regard as being aggressive or discriminatory in any way. But we're starting to get a next level of understanding. And I suppose that's quite difficult for a lot of people, particularly when that isn't just a blind spot. It's also like a common acceptance that that isn't a problem to ask somebody, for example, where they come from. But I think what you're doing here in this conversation and other people who are, you know, kind of educating the world is trying to help us empathize with what the experience of that feels like, how diminished one feels in a social setting when your very identity is being questioned in front of other people.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely it. It's the consistent othering of someone. And, you know, we're on a podcast now, so people can't see what I look like. But actually, one of the things I get a lot is if I'm on a phone call and if I was like, cover my video now, you wouldn't think that I look like how I look. And I talk about this a lot in the book because there is an element of privilege of that because I have the anonymity of an accent like mine and a name like mine, because you can't tell that I would maybe not be a white Irish woman because my name is standard Irish name and my accent is a standard Irish accent. But there's a lot that people need to understand that, you know, you don't have to be violently racist to be racist. and to really challenge that work. And I used to say this even to my dad before he passed away, when we would talk about this. And this was really eye-opening for him because, you know, he's raised two brown kids in a really white space, but he still really was really old from a generation that, you know, would say things that you would not say now. And I remember having a conversation with him about this, and he was like, oh, well, sure, how could I be racist? You know, I have you and David. And I was like, but just because you adopted two brown kids doesn't mean you can't be racist. Doesn't mean you can't actually still other people, because you view me and David as different. And it was really eye-opening for him to actually go on that journey. He's like, oh, yeah, right. Actually, I suppose that makes sense. And it's that kind of awareness that just because of X doesn't mean you can't do Y. Like, I can also, you know, be anti-Black because I'm not Black. And it's very important that we recognize that actually the systems that have been built with, you know, majority groups in mind, whether you think they're okay or not, you still benefit from them. Like, me and my partner talk about this a lot, because regardless of whether he would, you know, consider himself a racist, which he doesn't, he still benefits from white supremacy either way, because he's a white man. And so we have to have the conversation about what he really does with that to challenge it, not just, you know, say it and denounce it, but actually do something with the fact that he is treated differently. Because I think that's the really big thing that's important for me, is actually people have that self-awareness to know that you can do something about this. If you choose not to, you're being a really big part of the problem. And too many people sit in that idle, easy area, as opposed to, you know, demanding more, actually standing up and demanding it, as opposed to just expecting that, oh, it'll be okay. You know, it'll get better. History is telling us that it's not really getting that better. So yeah, that's where my head's kind of at with that.
Why do you think that the notion of, you know, privilege, or, you know, even when somebody, you know, doesn't see themselves as racist, but that they are benefiting from a sort of systemic kind of white supremacy, you know, experience, you know, why does the very suggestion of that seem to evoke such a kind of emotional response and sort of denial, you know, or do you experience that that's what's happening in your work? Do you see that people have that sort of emotive denial? That's not true. You know, I reject that, and therefore shuts down the conversation before it can go anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I see that in my work. I think whenever you mention privilege, people immediately have that, like, that gut-wrenching feel, that slap back, where it's like, well, why are you saying I have privilege when I've had X hard experience in my life, or Y has been really hard for me, or I've never gotten anything because of my skin color, or I've never gotten anything because I'm a man, or whatever it might be. And for me, the conversation, when you take a really one or zero or a binary view of privilege, you really hide the nuance of the conversation that needs to happen, which is why, again, in the book and externally, I write and I talk a lot about, you know, the balance of being underrepresented yet privileged. Both of those things can be true. You know, the world doesn't exist in one and zeros. So what's key in those conversations for me is really unearthing and delving into the more nuance and the more detail around privilege, how we see, for example, when we look at the intersections of race, class, and gender, for instance, that the treatment people have are incredibly different. The way the policies are defined are incredibly different. And for me, when it's actually helping people on that journey of recognizing privilege, I do share my own journey, because it's a very, I guess, niche and nuanced journey. Most people, I guess, don't have the background that I have, but also the self-awareness that I've spent a really long time to get to this stage. Because I think when people realize that, you know, being privileged, there's nothing you can do about that. That's fine. You are privileged. It's actually more meaningful to have a conversation about what you can do with it. But to do something with it, you have to have a conversation. And that's why I think that the conversation around privilege being, you know, entirely focused on, let's say, gender or ethnicity by itself isn't doing the conversation justice, because it is so much bigger than that. We've seen the effects of the pandemic prove that in its entirety, that the gaps of inequity are continuing to widen, but they're not just continuing to widen overall, but actually when we really drill down into it, it's those intersections that are being really affected, the intersection of gender, ethnicity, and class background. So taking an overall view is really just, you know, hiding the problem or pretending it doesn't exist, when it very much exists, and people are, you know, losing jobs, people are dying, people can't access what they need because of it. So that's where, yeah, I think what's important, that the nuance isn't lost in this.
Let's turn to your book. Love the title, Demand More. It's both provocative and confrontational at the same time, and empowering. Can you tell us about the genesis of the book and what your aim is with it?
Yeah, I mean, the reason why I wrote Demanding More, and I'll be honest, I didn't plan on writing a book at this stage in my career. I planned on writing maybe a book later, but my publisher reached out to me, and they'd been following my work externally for quite a bit, and had said, you know, we'd love if you would expand on this. You know, you talk a lot about privilege, you talk a lot about inclusive technologies and inclusive systems. Do you want to write a book on it? And I batted the idea around a lot, because I didn't say yes right away, because I really wanted to think about, you know, what can I add to the conversation? What do I want people to take away? And one of the first things for me was really quite a lot of books on this topic are not accessible to everyone, regardless of whether they're in business or not. And as someone who was, I was the first person in the entire Atchison family to go to university. I'm the first of many in my family to do a lot of different things. I wanted it to be a book that if my dad was to pick it up, he could easily get something from it. And that it wasn't just for those that were privileged enough to be already in business. Because that is a privilege, regardless of what level you are in business, being there in the first place, having that seat at all is a privilege. And I really wanted it to be something that broke down, complex topics in an accessible way, in a way that people could really maybe sit down, take a hard look at themselves and resonate with something. Even if they didn't get the entire thing, there was still bits and pieces that really helped them on that journey. And for me, with Demanding More, it's really, I guess, you know, it's both my personal experience, it's got a lot of theory, and it's got a lot of practical advice. And the practical advice piece is something that I think is really key, because what I wanted people to be able to take away was, okay, you've had a hard look at yourself, you've spent some time going on that journey, but what's next? And all too often the what's next is left up to people's own devices. And you don't know what you don't know. And that's a really big problem in general. But again, if you have something to share and you're able to help people on that journey, I think it can be really, really impactful. And it's why when I wrote it, that I really wanted to write it for anybody, regardless of where they were at in the business, whether they had a business, they didn't, whatever stage of life they were in, whether they had higher education or not, none of that was relevant to me. And that's something, I guess, from my own personal perspective, that's always really important to me. It's the reason why I chose Women Who Code to branch, because they didn't charge for events. And that was really key for me, because not everybody can afford XYZ. And with the book, whilst, you know, it's still a privilege to be able to buy a book or whatever, it was still to be able to write something that really anybody could take something away for, that they could start to demand more because they knew maybe a bit more about the background, where to start and where to go.
So picking up on the question that Scott asked earlier on about privilege and the point you made around it elicits a defensive reaction in people, mm. It rocks them on their heels because it's an accusation of something. And something I was reading recently from Michael Sandel, the philosopher around meritocracy, resonates with this, that privilege isn't something that you earn. It's a position of what you're born into, your genes, your family history, and so on. So it's systemic. You know, certain people are born lucky into a place where they're the privileged ones, and so privileges can be just that you happen to be born in, you know, an environment where there's clean water and healthy, abundant food, and you know, and it's not violent. I mean, you know, that's privilege.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. Like I went back to Sri Lanka, and I found my biological birth mother, and people, I guess, it's very easy to sometimes have a very lofty view of privilege, but I spend a lot of time even before that, which was maybe, was it 4 years ago now? I think I went back, that actually, I considered myself to have a really good handle on my own personal privilege then, from being adopted, from having a Western name and an accent like mine, despite still also facing bias because of that same accent. But actually, when I went back and I found her, and, you know, she lived in this wee small like hut with no air conditioning, with no pillow. When it was warm, she slept on the ground outside. I have a half sister, and her husband live reasonably okay, and actually they're fine, but she wasn't being looked after. And so there's, when you start to see, actually, if I hadn't have been lucky enough, and there's that luck word again, lucky enough to have been put up for adoption, I very much would have been in a very similar position. Would I be, you know, financially stable, traveling the world, training and working with some of the biggest companies in the world? Of course I wouldn't have been. But that's all luck. And I also think, I talk about it in Demanding More, where I was actually supposed to be adopted by a German family, but my family arrived, like, I think it was like 15 minutes early or something. We're clearly very eager. And, you know, adoptions in the 90s are very different to adoptions now. And so instead of them getting a different girl, they got me. So I could have been in Germany just with that, like, taxi being slightly earlier. And that's what I think, that when we talk about the transition of privilege, you know, that one decision, that first one decision, the second of my parents even considering adopting because they couldn't have kids, and then the experience I have, has all been based off that one very big, big piece of luck. There is no skill to me being adopted. But that has opened up this world of opportunity that, even regardless of the bias or the discrimination or anything that I face, it is an incredibly privileged lifestyle nonetheless. And that's why I really want people to get that, to grips with that, that, you know what, it's okay to accept that, and you should accept that. By not accepting that, you're really, I guess, taking a very false view of how the world exists. And I know my experience is very different than most, but I think it's a really good example of how big luck can just play into somebody getting an incredibly better life than what they could have had.
So this idea of privilege, you know, having an emotive reaction and people sort of denying that, I imagine the very suggestion of bias would evoke a similar response in people, sort of suggesting, well, that's not me. I don't have that. You referenced that earlier when you were talking about the story with your father. You know, in this idea of having a hard look at ourselves, I find that, you know, when we talk about even the idea of self-awareness, you know, John and I have talked about this on the show before, that, you know, oftentimes the people that need more awareness, most of the people that need more awareness are, you know, are the least likely to recognize that they need to develop more awareness. And so that's why it's hard to get very far in this idea of, you know, raising awareness and emotional intelligence and these things. From a bias perspective, and in your book, in challenging people to have a hard look at themselves, can you comment on that in terms of your experience in working with others and helping them to connect with the idea that, yeah, maybe I do have some bias?
Yeah, of course. I think the first thing that I really do around these conversations is, people think that bias is some sort of lofty thing that just happens, but actually don't really spend a lot of time or have any consideration of the really big real world impact that it has. And that's why in the book, for example, I spend quite a lot of time really sharing around how the bias against different groups of people has directly impacted policy creation, process creation in business, the access to senior leadership in business, and so on. But actually, what I think is really key in those conversations is the understanding that personal actions, no matter how small they are, have a knock-on effect. And now, people will disregard that. And so what I tend to do, and why my work is incredibly data-driven in businesses, is that I actively, I guess, survey and monitor how people from all different backgrounds are feeling under certain leaders. So really getting a pulse of, you know, what do, for example, women of color feel like around belonging or non-discrimination versus white women? What about people in the UK versus US? What about this? What about that? To actually have some sort of data point to talk about, well, maybe you think that your work or your impact or your actions aren't having that impact, but actually what we're seeing is white men in your team are much happier than, let's say, women of color, or people or disabled people are much less comfortable getting management support than non-disabled people. So regardless of whether you think you're not having an impact or not, you very clearly are. And the accountability piece is really key there, because you will always get people who say, I don't care anyway. I'm here to do X, Y, Z, to make revenue, and that's it. And that's why when it comes to actually embedding this, I spend a lot of time with senior leaders who are willing to ally and get with this, so we can embed it into processes around performance management and so on, to make sure that actually, I don't care whether you don't get it or not, you're going to be rated on it and you're going to get paid less if you don't do it well. So you either care more and do it right, or you don't do it and then you don't perform in the way that you think that you're going to. So it's really, really key that the accountability that's embedded in there, because there will always be people that think bias is just some lofty thing that someone's made up so they can feel victimized.
So you said ally. Tell us more about allyship. What does it look like in reality?
For me, allyship is really about active intervening in this most base level. It's about actively intervening in person. It's about actively intervening when we're creating policies and processes. It's about speaking up. It's about calling out how something may affect someone differently, even if you are not in that group. And for me, with allyship, the really key part here is that we recognize that there are actions that we must do, but there are also actions at a systemic level in companies and societies and so on that we must do as well. So it's not just an individual thing, but actually, how do we hold to account, for example, our peer groups? How do we continue to actually embed allyship into processes around sponsorship, around amending what actually we define as successful and failure? Because more often than not, that's incredibly biased. And a big part of the book, when I talk about allyship, is really about actually what does work and what doesn't work. What is performative allyship, which is really when it's more about you than what you're actually trying to help. It's more about, well, look at me, I'm doing something really great. Give me a like, give me a high five, give me whatever it might be. And it centers yourself. And I've seen that a lot. It's very easy to fall into that trap of, well, I'm trying my best, so be grateful. And this touches on, I guess, what you both had said at the start. You know, intention and impact are very different things. And that conversation is really important in allyship, because if your intention, regardless of whether your intentions are good or bad, if the impact is negative, if the impact isn't what's needed, if the impact is centering yourself, it doesn't matter whether your intentions were good. So the response of, well, I was trying my best and, you know, I had good intentions here, so why are you having a go at me? Well, actually, it's irrelevant. The point here is for you to sit back and listen and learn. And I think people as a whole struggle with that, because it's really reworking how we communicate. A lot of people, and I talk about this in Demanding More as well, a lot of people listen to have their chance to speak, as opposed to listening to learn. And they're two very different things, but yet more often than not, people are doing the first one a lot.
Hi folks, Phil Kirby here, producer of the show. If you're enjoying The Evolving Leader and would like to stay connected with us between episodes, follow us on Twitter at evolving_leader. And please be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We really appreciate your support. Thanks for listening.
So I'm fascinated about how we're going to accelerate this process of creating inclusive cultures. Part of me hopes, although you said earlier on history doesn't hold out much hope for this, that our younger generations seem to be gender and race blind. A lot have been talked about that, whether that's true or not, but I see that in my children, my friends' children and so on. It does feel different. It feels like certain things have been eliminated in society. Jokes are different. You know, people don't do imitations of foreign dialects anymore on television. You know, there has been some norms that have fundamentally changed, but we've seen with Black Lives Matter over the last couple of years that we've got just a massive distance still to travel. So I'm wondering, you know, like, what's the systemic thing? Because I just want to come back to this privilege thing for a moment, because, you know, part of what we have tried to drive the last few decades is the concept of meritocracy being a way, particularly in Britain, of closing class divides. That doesn't seem to have worked. And I think part of what, you know, coming back to the earlier point, is that privilege is something that you don't see. because it's normal to you. Your privileged position, whatever that privileged position is, normality to you. So, but it provides you with an unfair advantage in a meritocracy.
Yeah.
And the other part of that is that you assume that your privilege you created. So yeah. if you're the, you know, the fastest, you know, runner in the Olympics, a big part of that, yes, of course you trained hard, but so did everybody else. But a big part of that is that you had genetics that other people didn't have.
Yeah.
You also happened to be in a situation where the other world's fastest runner hasn't been born yet.
Mm.
So you end up, but you then, you know, you make this assumption that you made your success. So I'm just wondering, how do we evolve the system that doesn't assume that privilege is something that, you know, we are responsible for? It's something that's not, it's not something we created. And, you know, some of the attempts for things like, you know, quota systems and so on seem to be blunt instruments. They don't change the system. I wonder what thoughts you have in trying to create this inclusive culture.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we talk about meritocracy and things like that, we're very much hiding away from the very clear discrepancies and access to opportunities that people have. I mean, I know just yesterday in the UK, Prime Minister here, who had attended Eton on an EU scholarship because his father was an MEP, regularly kept saying twice in an interview that children of wealthy parents have access to private tutoring, in quotes, because of their parents' hard work. And then again, the kids of well-off parents, thanks to their hard work. And again, the assumption here is that actually hard work is directly equating to wealth, which is why we have those very, very clear systemic biases against poorer people. And it also really, really disregards the privilege that many of these, in quotes, wealthy parents have accumulated through generational wealth, through connections, through business acumen. And for me, the really big thing that we need to do is the interrogating of processes on how it affects those different groups. Many, many organizations do not capture any data on who applies to their roles, who is in their promotion ranks, who is in their business, and so on. And there are different legal ramifications or legal laws and so on in different countries, certainly around Europe, of what you can and can't do. However, many organizations that can do it are not doing it. So what we're finding out is actually people are being able to take a vague view of, well, we don't know if it's not working, but you don't know because you're not trying to find out. And until we start to try and find out what's happening on a more structured way, people are able to continue to say, oh, well, we just hire the best person for the job. We just promote all the best people. They just all happen to be men who went to Oxbridge. And that's what's really key here, that we have those new data-driven conversations to hold people to account. I also think that people need to get used to the fact that as we go on this journey, that means that there are certain people in your business that will be let go, because you cannot think that if there are people that certainly in leadership positions and so on that are directly pushing against, let's say, the inclusion commitment or the diversity and inclusion commitment that your business makes, that that means that they're an appropriate fit for a business, especially when they're in decision making. And too many people and too many organizations want to try and toe the line of, we care about this, but we don't care enough to make a difficult decision. You have to make those difficult decisions for the impact that you're talking about. I also think that actually, you know, the younger generation, there is some progress, but I really don't want people to be colorblind. I want people to really understand and respect that there are all different races and ethnicities and the nuance of that, because when we're colorblind, we're pretending that actually everybody's treated the same. Nobody is treated the same. And to really change that, we have to have our next generation aware of that. And I do believe that because of, I guess, the more open conversations we have, because more people that care about this are having children through whatever means that may be, and are raising kids with these things in mind, that a good portion of the next generation care about this and are growing up caring about this. And I really hope that that continues to translate into change as we all, you know, get older and everything else too.
That's a really good challenge to me, actually, in terms of thinking. And it's an assumption that, you know, we're making progress, and a mixture of kind of not really thinking about it hard enough, and making some assumptions about the fact that we are making a form of irreversible progress, when in fact actually what we are seeing is a contextual change, where things that are fundamentally not changing just look different because of the circumstances. So I just want to come back to this this point about the beginning. You said, so taking a hard look at ourselves.
Yeah.
So Scott and I, two white guys, although actually, full disclosure, I'm half Indian and half Irish. So even though I don't look it. What would you say, you know, to somebody like us in terms of what does that looking hard at yourself entail? Mm. What should we be doing?
For me, looking hard at yourself means spending time really delving into your experience in the world, not just in business, but actually how do you exist in the world and how is the world facilitated for you to exist? And that's the really big part here is actually some of us have it easier than others because the world was made with them in mind. Now, for us to really change that, we have to understand why that was done, because of exclusion and discriminatory practices and so on. But what can we do about it? And what I want people, when they take a hard look at themselves, is to go on that journey where maybe, you know, maybe it is upsetting for you a bit. Maybe it is kind of difficult at points, because it really means that you have to recognize that whilst it may have been hard for you, it could have been harder. But by doing that, you have an ability to then to really start to change the narrative and do that intervening that I'm talking about, because you have an awareness of actually this could be different and how can I make it different. And I think the main thing about that introspection is that it's continuous. You know, I just because I have a strong self-awareness of that now, that's really been a journey for me. You know, I didn't just have that awareness and know all of this stuff. It's really been sitting down and, you know, really thinking about, you know, well, actually, what could have been different? What could have been, you know, better or worse and so on? And looking at it from the big picture as well, like it's not just about like one or two things we're talking about. It's not just about your life and work, but actually when it comes to like thinking about even accessing mortgages, think about where you can live, how you can live, what jobs are you able to get to because of where you live? When you think about, you know, your formative years of where you're raised, and certainly in, you know, Northern Ireland, it's a very different conversation as well because of the war that happened and because of the huge divide between two religions that are almost very identical in the grand scheme of things. But actually that has very much shaped around access to opportunity in Northern Ireland because of then where you're distributed, where you live, where that has previously been a poor area is still a poor area because of those access to opportunities. And that recognition and that going on that educational journey, I think, can be really insightful. I also think what's a key part of that is having those conversations with like friends that you can trust and your family and so on. Because we all don't exist just by ourselves for the most part. You know, we maybe have friends, we maybe have a partner, maybe we have kids, maybe we have family that's around us. And going on that journey together sometimes is easier than going on it by yourself. But I think it's an incredibly worthwhile one. I also would ask people to not be put off by how long maybe it feels like it's taking them, because it's a continuous process. Like I was sitting talking to my partner yesterday, even just because the life that we have now, having just bought our first home entirely by ourselves with our own money that we've saved up for a deposit and everything else, is not something that like a lot of people do. We see a lot of stories about people that have generational wealth that makes this easier and everything else, but still we have been able to be in a position where we have two jobs that are very well paid to do this, and we've been able to do this because of XYZ. So it's that recognition that even though we come from poorer backgrounds, we don't have that background anymore. That's not our lives anymore because we have done those things. So it's a continuous process. Like I'm one of the things in the book, in the privilege section, is the privilege walk, where it's about people stepping forward and back depending on their answer. And it gives you a score at the end. Now it's not, you know, all of the things you would consider, it's like 50 something questions, but it's to open that conversation. And when I run that in groups, what we really find is that you get a scattergraph of people with a lot of different perspectives that people wouldn't consider. Oh, I know when I did that exercise myself a number of years ago, my score was much, much lower than what it is now. And I imagine in, 5 years, even 10 years, it'll be much, much higher than it is now too. So it's really about that awareness that, life changes, your experience in life changes, and so does everybody else's. So let's remember that it doesn't just evolve around us singularly.
That is so helpful. I love this idea of demanding more, starting with demanding more of ourselves by taking a hard look at ourselves, getting honest with what we see and what we've experienced and the privilege that we've had. For those listening who say, I'm gonna do that more intentionally, but I also want to get involved on influencing more positive change where I'm at, like in my organization, in my community, what advice might you give that person?
What I would say is that if you're in a community or in an organization, what you should do is start to reach out to other people that are also really wanting to do something about this. It can be very lonely to try and do it by yourself, but you can also be very sure that you're not the only person thinking about this. Coming together, collecting and collating efforts and passion is much more effective for yourself and for the wider piece than going it alone. The second thing I would say is to think about the ways that you can personally start to speak up. Maybe you're not in a position of leadership that you can do that in work, but maybe you're at home and you can do that. Or maybe you have friends that you can talk to about this. Maybe you have some connections to people that aren't just yourself, so you can start to actually influence wider. And whenever you're influencing wider, the third thing is continue or start to read about this, start to embed yourself with education on this, and continue to read about it, continue to get those different perspectives. Because otherwise what you'll tend to find is that you'll only really care about the things that directly impact you, which actually just creates more exclusionary inclusion. Mm. And what we really need to do is push that boundary, see things wider than just ourselves, and remember that, the world doesn't exist in an echo chamber, so neither should we.
Mm. That's a really important, because I think the more passionate people are about something, the more they risk pushing others away. Mm. And obviously they're doing it because they need to desperately change the dialogue and so on. But they're in that, it's kind of counter to the whole inclusionary process that you're trying to encourage. And that's really difficult, isn't it? That's very difficult to hold the tension between those two things.
Yeah, I think passion definitely is important in this. I think what's also key with passion is just remembering that there's a skill set to diversity and inclusion work as well. And the two things are not the same. And when it comes to really honing that passion, it's just to really remember that inclusion for you is not the same as everybody. So it's, for example, if we're talking about gender inclusion, if you only care about white women, you're completely ignoring the intersection of disability, of race, of class, of sexual orientation and everything else. And so that's why to make sure that your passion is actually useful, widen those horizons, keep pushing those out. Because what we don't need is just more people who are just only trying to look after themselves. It's just too big for that.
Yeah. Mm. You've got so many kind of thought processes and tools and so on that you have developed to help hold yourself accountable to the things that you believe in, because it's easy to default into reactivity, particularly when emotions start to overwhelm the situation. Can you give our listeners some advice about how you set your intent around this? So when you're in that situation, particularly when you're met with some, a situation which you haven't encountered before, or you feel self-conscious around it, how do you set your intent so that you do the greatest good in that situation?
So I think that the first thing is take a step back. So more often than not, people as a whole will rush to try and make a decision, do something quickly, but actually taking a step back to reassess all of the things that are going on, as opposed to just a very small vertical, can really, really help with setting intent and meeting that intention. I always describe my job as really, my role is to put friction into processes of decision making, because friction slows people down. And when you slow people down, you stop them making decisions based on assumption and bias. And with intention, I think one of the things you've mentioned is, I guess, people can feel overwhelmed. What I would say to people is that you can't change everything overnight, and nor should you try to. What you should do is consider, if you're really starting out on this, like, consider one or two smaller things that you can really commit to. Is it reading more about this? Is it talking about this in your circle? Is it, you know, reaching out to people within work and starting to kick off a council or a think tank around this? Is it reaching out to your leaders in work to hire someone like me to help do this? I'm considering, actually, you know, if I can do those one to two things really well in like 1 to 2 months or something, then start to move forward, start to like consider those successes because they are. But I think one of the things people try firstly is to go so big and so wild that they then get so overwhelmed and feel bad that they can't meet the goals they tried to do because they started at something that, you know, it's unattainable until you do the other smaller things. So I always suggest to people is, you know, start small, start together with people, and then move forward. Again, that collaboration and community piece can be really impactful.
Well, I feel personally challenged, so thank you, honestly. And I feel inspired. I feel a bit of hope. I feel a bit of sadness around some of it too, if I'm honest. I'm feeling a lot, and I really want to do the hard work of looking at myself in this as well. So I do sincerely appreciate you and having you come on. Where can people find your book?
So Demanding More is available everywhere. It's at all major outlets. You can get it on Amazon if you want to. You can get it direct. You can get it at Barnes & Noble, everywhere and anywhere. If you Google Demanding More, you will find it wherever you want.
And on social media, where can people find you?
Yep. So you can get me on Twitter at Neerashika. And I'm on LinkedIn at my name, and my Instagram the same. If you want to contact me, you can get me through my website, which is shereeatchison.com.
Yeah, and I thoroughly recommend the book. I found it challenging in a very positive way, and I thought the diagnostic was incredibly helpful.
Good. Well, you got to leave a reading and a review that says that now then.
I was waiting to talk to you because obviously, you know, got to make sure that there's coherence
that it
between,
matches,
you know.
Of course.
No, that's been wonderful. And Sherry, I think, you know, what you're doing, your story is inspiring. It's something that the world needs more of. You need more followers in this. And you are definitely an evolving leader. So we're very proud to have spent some time with you. And we're just a little bit more privileged as a result. So,
thank you very much for having me. It's been great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So be sure to pick up a copy of Demanding More today. And until next time, remember, the world is evolving. Are you?